to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Celia Farber, and my co-host Christina Borgeson is out on the road on a story. I am hosting the show from Granada, Spain, and our audio is going to be somewhat less than ideal. Jesse, are we good sound wise?
Yes, we sound fine, and Christina's on Skype.
Oh, Christina's with us.
Can you hear me?
Hi, Christina. Great.
Hi.
Okay. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome our guest today, somebody whose work I admire tremendously, and I've been so curious about him. He is an author, a historian. His name is Forrest Marady, and he's written four books, all told, about a subject that troubles me probably more than any other, namely the autism pandemic and catastrophe. His latest book is called The Autism Vaccine, The Story of Modern Medicine's Greatest Tragedy. And I just want to read a tweet that where somebody who has, I haven't read the book yet, but I've read about the book, and I can't wait to read it when I get back to the States. But here's the tweet from a reader. I just finished reading Forrest Marady's new book. It is a masterpiece. I see now why pharma is so terrified of this book. The debate is over. We know what causes autism and how to prevent it. Welcome, Forrest Marady. Are you there?
Hey, can you hear me, Celia? I'm here and happy to be here.
Okay, great. So we're all together here. I'm delighted, Christina, that you could join us.
Me too.
This conversation is a big one, but we're going to start. And we're going to start it where we can. Forrest, one of the things that fascinates me so much about you is that you have gone into the history of autism, and not just the recent history of autism, where the debate and the psychosis has been spinning, right, since essentially the early 90s when the hit job came down on Andrew Wakefield. And nobody's really reached back and tried to trace where this phenomenon originated. So in your new book, let's just start with this pinpoint on the map. You talk about how 1932 was a really bad year for what was to come. Tell us about that, if you would.
Sure thing. As you said, the book is a historical account of autism and also a very particular vaccine that most people have never researched or done much looking into. And what happened is there was a disease or a bacterial infection in the 1900s that was killing thousands of children. It's called diphtheria. Most people maybe have heard of it. Most people have never looked into it. It was a horrible infection. It sort of came out of nowhere and started infecting children, infecting adults, but the children really suffered because it would create white, leathery patches on their tongue and throat. It would cause them to have trouble breathing. It would cause them to have trouble eating. And they were trying very hard to figure out something to do about it. Now, unfortunately, at the time, medical care left a lot to be desired, to say the least. And metallic medicines were commonly used, mercury to clear the bowels, arsenic. They would even burn off these patches off the children's tongues and throats with muriatic acid. Medical care was not very good. And so the vaccine they developed, although it wasn't really truly a vaccine, but let's call it a vaccine, it didn't work very good. And it had another problem. It was grown in horse blood. And you can imagine injecting horse blood, although they tried their best to clean it up, when they injected it into children, eventually they would have allergic reactions to some of the proteins in the horse blood. And at the time, they didn't really have a name for it. The, you know, allergy wasn't a commonly used term. And in fact, it had never been used until 1904. But in the 1910s and 1920s, they were injecting this diphtheria vaccine into children. And the second or third time they did it, these children would get deathly ill. And they called it serum sickness because they didn't, you know, they didn't understand allergy. And they were really looking for a way to improve the efficacy of the shot and also, more importantly, to reduce it down to one, because it was always the second or third shot where these kids got serum sickness. If you know anything about allergy, you know the first exposure is not that bad. It's the repeated exposure, second and third time, where you really have problems. So when they figured out that by adding an aluminum ingredient into the vaccine that it worked much better, their hope was that children would only need one shot, and it would work fine, and they wouldn't have to deal with the allergy problem. So in 1932, in the United States, there was a nationwide diphtheria campaign. They added aluminum to it, and some very strange things started to happen within a year or two. I'll stop there and see if you have any questions.
What strange things? I mean, wait a second.
That's a cliffhanger.
We're going to get there. Hold your horses.
Yeah, so if I can just say really quickly, the way this is really interesting, if anyone's ever studied vaccines, they'll wonder, why did they put aluminum in there? Like, how in the world did they even come up with the idea that aluminum would help a vaccine? Well, it's actually used as a what they call like a precipitate. It clung to some of the nasty stuff in the horse blood. It stuck to it. And they used it to filter, and they actually called it to dehorse, if you can imagine that term. They tried to dehorse the serum before they injected it into children. And aluminum or potassium aluminum sulfate, sometimes called potash, had been used for thousands of years to filter water. And so they were using it in the vaccine to clean it up. Now, just serendipitously, as often happens with scientific experiment, some of the aluminum was accidentally left in there one time when they injected it into a horse, and they realized the horse produced massive amounts of antibodies. Rather than taking a few months, it took a few days. And they got the idea, well, maybe we can inject this into children, and their immune system will respond similarly. And in fact, they did. Aluminum causes a massive, massive immunological response. And that helps vaccines. That's why many of the vaccines children receive today have aluminum in it, because it causes a very, very aggressive response from their immune system. So, back to the question.
Okay. So aluminum functions as a kind of amplifier for vaccine.
Yeah.
So it amplifies the whole effect. Okay.
Yeah, they didn't understand it at the time, but they thought that that gets too nerdy. Let's not go there. they thought that aluminum slowed down the immune response because the aluminum was cleaving to the antigens in the vaccine. They thought the body spent extra time burning that stuff off, and as long as they could slow down the response, it would work better. That's, as we sort of discovered, that's not really what it was. But regardless, aluminum in a vaccine does work. It creates a very, very intense immunological response. Unfortunately, that immunological response appears to turn on itself and is probably a lot of the reason autoimmunity appeared around this time. So going back to the cliffhangers, in 1932, in the United States, they were having a nationwide diphtheria campaign. And most people don't know this, but that was really the only pediatric vaccine being pushed at the time. The smallpox vaccine was in existence, but it wasn't recommended as a matter of course. You know, there was no sort of sense that if you have a child, they must get a smallpox vaccine. The smallpox vaccine was used if there were outbreaks. There's something very odd about smallpox outbreaks in that you can sort of see them coming, you know, like a hurricane. On a Weather Channel map. I mean, you can really know it's coming. It doesn't just show up out of nowhere like modern infections seem to do. So people would hold off on getting it because it was a really nasty shot that no one wanted. They would hold off on getting it for their children until there was an imminent threat. Diphtheria was the very first vaccine that was recommended as part of a public health policy, like do your duty. If you have a child, you must get them this vaccine. That's really the first time in U.S. history, at least, that you ever see public health policy recommending every child receive a particular vaccine. And as I said, in 1932, the significant change happened. They added aluminum to it. And aluminum was actually used as a publicity stunt. It was a marketing gimmick, like the new aluminum precipitated diphtheria vaccine. You know, it was all in the news. They used that term to get people excited about, it's like saying turbo on a car, you know, or concentrate on a dish detergent. They were really excited about it. And the main reason they were excited was you only needed one shot. You know, like I said, multiple shots were horrible. Kids were dying from serum sickness, and parents were terrified of it. So the new shot was touted as being a lifesaver because it worked better because of the aluminum, and you only needed one shot because of the aluminum. So, as I mentioned, that year...
Give us a short list. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all right.
I wanted to ask you for the short list of previously unheard of illnesses that began to appear after aluminum is used in the vaccines in 1932.
Yeah, so in 1932, of course the book focuses on autism, but in 1932, a few things started to happen. There was a scientist, an American scientist, who was visiting in Paris in December, ate a meal at a restaurant and, in fact, ate some shellfish. His fingers puffed up, his face exploded, and he nearly died. And doctors were absolutely stumped. They had never seen anything like that before. And, in fact, if you go through the historical record, and I've done a lot of research on allergy, you will... And I can never find anything earlier than that that mentions food allergy. And in fact, they didn't really call it that because they didn't know what it was. It was just something they had never seen before. Now, obviously, I don't know if a scientist from America received a aluminum precipitated diphtheria vaccine, but it is more interesting because today scientists use aluminum as a way to purposefully induce food allergy. It's difficult to create food allergy. So in rats, if you want to create a rat with a allergy to cod liver oil, you administer cod liver oil, inject it sort of intravenously, and throw some aluminum, the same ingredient they use in vaccination today. You put that in there with it, and you can almost guarantee that rat is going to develop a food allergy to cod liver oil.
Wow.
They also use that same ingredient as a way to induce asthma in test subjects. So food allergy appeared in 1932. A scientist named Burl Bernard Crone published a paper in Alabama at some conference where he talked about 14 patients who had developed this chronic infection in their intestines that the body would not resolve. And they ended up naming it after him. They call it Crohn's disease. You may have heard of it. Same year.
Yes.
And thirdly, and this is obviously what the majority of the book is about, children, within a year or two, children started to display some strange neurological disorder that no one had seen before. They expressed isolation. They didn't want to play with their friends. They had no reaction to their parents. They had an obsession with patterns and order. And there was a psychiatrist working at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore named Leo Connor. He was the preeminent psychiatrist in America. He had a newspaper column. He would write frequently. You know, it was a syndicated column that was published all over the country, and he would talk about parenting things and child psychiatry. He also wrote a book in 1935 called Childhood Psychiatry. It was 500 pages long. It was considered the Bible of pediatric neurological disorders for years and years. It was the preeminent reference book for pediatric neurological disorders. And he was the preeminent childhood psychiatrist of the country. And because of that, people started bringing their children to him starting in 1935 with this new disorder that parents locally could find no doctor that had any idea what it was. If anyone knew what it was going to be Leo Kanner. You know, he knew everything about pediatric neurological disorders, and he had never seen it before. So,
this started in 1935, huh? I mean, you can pinpoint
the first patient he had ever seen. Yeah. Now, what's really fascinating is there was actually, and this is part of sort of the research and bombshell of my book that I've never heard anyone mention, is there was another country that was having a diphtheria problem. And it actually also created a nationwide campaign, just like the United States did. And it also made the change to the new aluminum-containing diphtheria vaccine at that same time. This country was Austria. And I found the research papers talking about their testing of it and the campaign. And there was a psychiatrist in Austria who also started to have children appear in his clinic with a new disorder that he had never seen before. His name is Hans Asperger, and you've probably heard of him.
Yeah.
Because the children he described, sometimes people call it Asperger syndrome. His paper came out in 1944 in America. Leo Kanner's paper came out 1 year earlier in 1943. They both used the term autism. And it was a symptom. Autism was originally a symptom. Autistic described children with schizophrenia because sometimes they exhibited this sort of aloneness and isolation. And they had no word for it. Asperger and Kanner had no word for it, so they called it. They ended up settling on autism. And
now, let me stop you there for a second, Forrest. Why did they call it autism? Do you know any more about that name, that word?
Well, that is sort of a word. It had been used in the medical literature, I think, since maybe 1914. Someone had used it, like I said, to describe it. I can't remember the word origin of it, but it's to describe the aloneness and isolation.
Oh, okay.
And you know, Kanner called it, I think he called it autistic disturbances of affective contact. And Asperger, who wrote it in, you know, it wasn't in English. I can't remember the title of his paper word. But, you know, when you initially identify a new syndrome, the response is not to try and name it right away. It's just a case report.
When these kids started coming to these shrinks, there was nobody was reporting any connection between, my son started acting strangely after he took this shot. Nobody was saying anything like that to the shrinks at the time.
Not that I can find. Leo Kanner's paper mentions, interestingly, one of the children having recently received a smallpox vaccination in passing. It doesn't appear like the parents are pointing to that. But no, it doesn't appear for decades later that anyone, medically at least, would even entertain the idea. Now,
how did the entertainment of the idea come to pass then?
Well, it started, as far as I know, publicly, it started in the 70s. I believe 1976, there was a reference Another smallpox reference to someone saying they thought maybe something about the smallpox vaccine had something to do with the onset of their child's autism. And you start to see it ramp up through the 80s and 90s. Of course, by the time the scientists at the Royal Free Hospital in London, one of which who was Andy Wakefield, by the time they wrote their paper, which, if you've ever read the paper, was studying the connection between gut illness and autism. But in passing, they mentioned that several parents had associated the MMR vaccine with the onset of their child's autism. And in the paper, they flat out say, we did not find an association between the vaccine and autism. You know, they were very clear about it. But it didn't matter. There was so much. The British, this gets into some other topics, but basically the British government appeared, a lawsuit was imminent with a faulty mumps vaccine, and there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, and they didn't like it. And so the 13 doctors who authored the paper were basically sort of the fall guy. The whole autism vaccine thing wouldn't spin out of control.
But so wait a second. Let me understand something. So in the 30s, these kids start going to these shrinks. So there's no connection to the physical, to a physical change because of vaccines. And so between the 30s and the 70s, what was going on in that period? I mean, the numbers were rising, right, of kids coming down with autism.
Not much. It was a very rare event back then. The first mention of it I can find in any newspaper, I believe, is in maybe 46 or 47. They didn't really understand what it was. There's some really almost hilarious accounts. That's a horrible word to use, but it's so poorly understood. You can see people trying to come to grips with this new type of disorder that they'd never seen before.
But then, when does it start to mushroom, and when is the connection made then, I guess? Yeah, because, I mean, you would think that if they were giving these things in the 30s, 40s, 50s, that the autism numbers would start growing. So why weren't they growing then, and why did they suddenly mushroom in the 70s, 80s, and 90s?
Well, at the time, 1932, there was a single vaccine children received. That diphtheria shot. In 1938, tetanus was added to it. It became a combo shot. 1942, pertussis, which is also called whooping cough, was added.
Right.
And that was really the only shot that children received other than polio in the 50s. And then the next one was measles in 1964, but that didn't really hit any sort of massive adoption until the 70s. But the real problem happens, unfortunately, you can sort of track it after 1986 when this legislation was passed to indemnify pediatric vaccine manufacturers from any sort of liability. Then the floodgates open and all sorts of new vaccines come online, many of which contain aluminum. And that's really where you see it start to shoot up. And then there's also another kick you get when these things start to become mandatory for school. So it's a combination of things.
Like over-vaccination. And so this stuff, whether it's the aluminum that causes it or whatever, I don't know, maybe you'll tell us what they've discovered in terms of what causes it. But it's almost like there's too many vaccinations and there's too much of something in the system and the system can't fight it and this is what happens. Is that it?
Yeah.
Too much profit and too little liability suddenly. So the industry is what mushrooms, the profit margin, the profit.
But I'm trying to figure out what happens in the bodies. I mean, why is it that all of a sudden...
There's basically... there are two major routes of autism in my mind, because the MMR vaccine is frequently been associated with autism, and it contains no aluminum and no thimerosal. It did initially, most people don't know this, but the original measles vaccine actually did contain aluminum very early in the 60s, but they took it out. They figured out it wasn't helping. So I'll quickly talk about MMR. Encephalitis is a known risk factor for autism. Encephalitis is swelling of the brain.
Right.
The measles virus itself has a unique ability to get into the brain and cause encephalitis. Now, normally, encephalitis is a temporary phenomenon that goes away. You know, you might get sick. You have some swelling of the brain. If you have a child, they'll scream bloody murder because their head's killing them. You'll notice their fontanelle, the soft spot on the top of their head. It'll become rock hard. And eventually, their body will clear the infection. The problem is if this infection continues for weeks, months, or years. Now, if you remember what I said about aluminum, it's really starting to become clear that it is associated with autoimmunity. It has a unique ability to make your body's immune system attack itself. So the hypothesis that I propose in the book is the measles vaccine alone is capable of creating encephalitis that can occasionally cause the symptoms of autism. The problem is, if the measles vaccine is administered in the presence of aluminum that came from other shots, you get what we call autoimmune encephalitis.
Right.
And autoimmune encephalitis is a real problem. It's very rare, thankfully, but you sometimes see it in adults. And in fact, I know someone who as an adult got it, and it was wild. I mean, they turned into a psychotic, paranoid, crazy person. Now, they had all their language skills fully developed at that time, so it didn't look like autism, but the way that it affected their brain was crazy. In a child,
so aluminum, the body can't get rid of aluminum. It doesn't get rid of it eventually. It just lives in the body forever, and that creates the problem?
Not forever. It will eventually clear it, but now this gets into a whole other topic. Of why girls seem to develop autoimmune disorders in their teens. I'm going to circle back to that one second. So that's the problem, in my opinion, with the MMR, which is really the measles component. In the presence of aluminum, you may have an encephalitic event go autoimmune, and that's when you have these long-running infections that the body can't clear. That's why, in my opinion, and I want to be clear, this is a hypothesis of mine. That is why I believe MMR is so frequently associated with autism. It's because of it's the vaccine, but there is aluminum circulating the body from previous vaccines, most likely. You know, most kids who get an MMR are likely to have received previous vaccinations. If you were only to receive the MMR and no aluminum, I wouldn't imagine autism would be a very high risk. It may, but I don't think so. So the aluminum itself is a neurotoxin. They didn't know this at the time, but it has the ability to destroy the myelin sheath around the axons of your brain. The myelin sheaths are like insulation around electrical wire. They keep your neurons from short-circuiting. They allow them to run right next to each other, but not touch each other. Aluminum hydroxide in vaccines can destroy that myelin sheath, and you end up with short-circuiting going on. Now, as I state in the book, my opinion is autism is actually a very specific problem in a very specific part of the brain, which is called the brainstem, which is underneath, you know, all the gray matter. You know, if you were to draw a brain on a piece of paper, you would draw this sort of spongy circular thing, but there's a little part that sticks down, and that's called the brain stem. And that's actually the most crucial component of your brain. That's the thing they try to sever when they hang people, because it will kill them instantly. You know, you can see pictures of, you know, people have a javelin through their brain, and they'll go through surgery and they'll come out no worse for the wear, other than they can speak German and or play the piano, you know. But if you have an injury like that on your brain stem, it will kill you. There's no doubt about it. So a very tiny injury within the brainstem can cause all sorts of problems, particularly in an area called the reticular formation, which is where all the it's basically the input and output switchboard of your brain. And it's where sensory things are controlled. It's where response to external stimuli are controlled. And the theory is if damage occurs here, then children will naturally not respond to external stimuli, and that explains the aloneness. Now, I can explain, this is something that's kind of horrible, but I feel like I have to talk about it to explain to people because it's sort of a crucial component of my theory about all of these things. The aluminum hydroxide in vaccines is very little. You know, it would, on the surface, would seem that it's not enough in there to affect people. You know, it's so little. How could that little amount, even though we know it's a neurotoxin, we don't want to put it in there. The vaccine won't work without it, however. How could that neurotoxin cause so much damage? And the reason is we've recently discovered this through some scientific research that aluminum, and if I can just explain really quickly, the aluminum I'm talking about is not like silvery liquid, like you can imagine breaking a thermometer and seeing, you know, mercury. It's nothing like that. It's a white powder. It's a crystalline powder. And it's actually a salt. It's not really, you can't really call it a metal, but it's just easier to refer to it as a metal. Regardless, this aluminum in the vaccines is attacked by your body's immune system because it thinks it's an invader. That makes sense, right? So white blood cells surround the aluminum. And what we know is white blood cells don't float around your body randomly, but they are signaled to go to places by your immune system. So if you get a cut, your body sends white blood cells there to help. What we've recently discovered is if you get a cut, your brain sends requests for help to come to the brain with white blood cells. Now, you and I can sit here and guess and hypothesize as to why this is, but we don't really know. It does make sense, however, that an advanced life form would sort of preemptively, proactively request help from its immunological system if it detected harm. So if you get a cut, your brain signals for help from white blood cells. Unfortunately, after vaccination, those white blood cells are likely to contain aluminum. If your body detects a pathogen invasion, be it bacterial, viral, fungal, whatever, your body also sends white blood cells to your brain for help. And the third thing, which is really, I'm convinced, is probably the main factor in all of this, is has to do with fear and restraint. And you may know about this, but you've heard of fight or flight, right? Fight or flight.
Yeah.
So if you're afraid and you feel like something may be about to kill you, all sorts of changes happen in your body. Your heart rate goes up. You know, if you're really terrified, you may feel indigestion, like you need to go to the bathroom, because your body is basically diverting all resources to fighting or fleeing. Your immune system drops, which is why people get sick when they're stressed, because not much energy is being devoted to your immune system. You may have trouble digesting food because all the energy that would normally go to digestion is diverted elsewhere. So this is fight or flight. There's actually another step beyond that, and there's a doctor named Dr. Stephen Porges who has a thing called the polyvagal theory. If you ever want to read about it, it's a fascinating exploration onto the human body's response to stress. And what he talks about is when fight or flight don't appear to be viable options for survival, you go into another phase, which he calls death feigning. And death feigning is sort of like when a possum plays dead.
Right.
They're not actually playing dead. They're not pretending to be dead. There's a biological, biochemical event that happens that causes them to go catatonic. They're not pretending. They're not holding their breath and closing their eyes. They are literally, involuntarily catatonic. They don't wake up when they think the coast is clear. They wake up when their chemistry has been restored. So in humans, we don't play dead, but we do have a similar response to immobilization and restraint. And so the theory that I've sort of developed is this is why children who are 12 to 18 months old seem to have the most issues with neurological disorders after vaccination. At that age, they are the most afraid. If you're a four-month-old or a six-month-old, you know, you have no idea what's coming. You can't be afraid of it. If you're 4 years old or 6 years old and you're a parent, you know, you can promise them a milkshake from Dairy Queen if they don't cry or if they don't fuss. But when you're 12 to 18 months old, you're not, you can't understand what's happening. You don't know why this is happening. And they're not, their verbal skills are not good enough to reason with them. So unfortunately, those three things that I just mentioned, tissue injury, which is if you get cut, a pathogen invasion, and fear that comes from immobilization and restraint, those three things that cause white blood cells to rush into the brainstem, those all occur during vaccination. And that's my hypothesis as to why vaccination is a unique situation that goes beyond just the ingredients. It's not just the ingredients. If you were to drink those ingredients, I don't think it would cause as many neurological problems. It's because they're administered under fear. Because they're administered in a situation that often requires immobilization and restraint. If you've seen pictures, and you and me as a parent may have remembered doing this, restraining your kid, penning them down. It's a horrible, horrible thing for me to even suggest. And I've gotten used to talking about it, but for the first few months, I struggled to keep it together when I talked about it. I was so disturbed by it.
Yeah,
you're absolutely on to something so huge, Jeb, because, and I want to tell you something, I don't know if you know this, in Sweden, where I grew up, in many ways it's a very repressive society, but in some ways a very advanced and conscious society. And one of the things, about a year ago, Sweden's parliament voted on mandatory vaccination. And the reason it was struck down was because it's in the constitution that you cannot forcibly restrain another person. They actually equate it with assault and even with potential homicide, since vaccines have killed people. So it's a form of assault. So it was struck down on those grounds. And I wish that would become a thing in the U.S. vaccination debate. When I see these videos of these kids being held down, I watched one yesterday, it just made me almost cry. It's like they're surrounded by adults. It's like a horror thing, you know, four of them, and they're coming at them from different directions with these big needles. They go simultaneously in the leg and the arm and the other. You've seen that, right? No, so as
I can't watch it anymore. In fact, I black out if I ever show a picture of someone getting vaccinated. I black it out.
Yeah, you're on something very important there, and we've become so desensitized to children in our society that we just think, well, you know, so what? It's a little thing. And you're so right. It's not the pain of the needle. It's the whole situation, which is a complete and utter destruction of the child's sense of safety and sovereignty.
Yeah. So, if I may, two more quick things. This creates a problem in terms of doing safety testing for vaccines, because scientifically, the tendency is to look at the ingredients. But the way in which it's administered, I believe, has as much of an impact on the potential for neurological complications. So you cannot test vaccines on an adult population because they won't be scared. You cannot test the ingredients on a child, truly get the signature of what happens during a vaccination event. You can't do it unless they're afraid. And of course, there's no way anyone would ever fund or greenlight a scientific study in which you were purposely restraining and terrifying a child. So that really makes you wonder if the study that would simulate what happens during vaccination would never be greenlit. Why are we doing this as a matter of course? You know, there's something wrong there.
Yeah.
So I want the other thing you, I wanted to... go ahead.
Yes, go ahead. No, I wanted to ask you this. You just touched on something. You said that you get very emotionally affected, which is very, very understandable. Was there something... What was it that made you devote so much of your... writing time and historical work to this subject? Was there something personal to you about this? Because as we all know, this is the toughest terrain pretty much that there is. And I want to ask you later how you've been attacked and censored, because I know you must have been.
Yeah, I don't talk about my family much. We've sort of made a decision as a group to not talk about it, but we don't have autism in my family. So it's not autism itself is not something personally that has affected us as my immediate family. But beyond that, it has tremendously affected us, and other vaccination related issues have affected us as a family. But I'm a curious person. I have a very high empathy score. And when I see, when I say empathy score, I'm talking about a personality profile test. I can't help it. I can't help but to think children are being harmed needlessly, and parents are having to deal with it, and families are being ruined. You know, there's divorce, there's careers come to halt. There's all sorts of fallout from autism that never gets counted on the stat sheet, far beyond the effect of just the child themselves and the abilities and lives that they may have led, how they've changed. So I don't know why this struck me so acutely, but it's just sort of a strong moral compass, I suppose, that feels like wrong is being done, and I can't stand by and let it happen without saying something. I mean, this was never my career choice. You know, I had no dreams of being a controversial author who gets death threats for trying to expose the truth about things. I never wanted that.
Who threatens you?
It's the internet. It's the anonymity that the internet provides. It provides people a way to vent their frustration. So it's not a pleasant thing if you've ever been out on the internet as a public figure and said something that other people don't like. Autism and vaccines are probably one of the single most contentious subjects out there, because think about it. If this is right, if all these parents are right, and vaccines did in fact cause their children's autism, we have a very, very big problem on our hands. I mean, if you really try to just step back for a second and think, what does that mean if the majority of the world accepted that vaccines are capable of causing autism? What does that mean? It means a lot of things that I don't know if the majority of the world is prepared to deal with. You know, it is the single most prolific, ubiquitous, far-reaching modification of humanity that's ever been done. This is decades and decades and decades of massive vaccination in children. And if what we did is capable of causing autism, if what we did is capable of causing autoimmune disorders, food allergies, all sorts of other things. And in fact, some of these things appear to be able to extend over multiple generations. And it's something I talk about in the book. We can't just pass it on to your kids. Well, it's yes. Unfortunately, it appears that there's the chance of this happening, and it's not a contagious thing. I can explain it. But yes, I'll circle back to that. It appears that the problem is very severe, and I don't think we as a species are prepared to handle it. That's why you see such violent, vitriolic reactions to this, because it creates cognitive dissonance that maybe we have actually been hurting our children. No parent wants to hear that. No doctor wants to hear that. No public health official. None of these people are evil. Everyone wants the best for children. I'm not. People say pharma is evil. Doctors are evil. I don't believe that. I don't agree with that. I think they're well-intentioned people. I think there's certainly some mean components to them.
Well, what do you say to people? Like right now, there seems to be a lot of a lot of articles about measles outbreaks, and you know, because of unvaccinated kids and so on. What do you say to the pro-vaccine people who say, well, you know, this has kept us from having measles outbreaks or chickenpox outbreaks or whatever? What do you say to them?
Well, measles, let's talk about measles. Measles is a innocuous, trivial childhood infection in any first world country. No one feared it before the vaccine. No one was clamoring or crying for a vaccine. There was no foundation. There was no measles foundation where people were donating thousands of dollars in hopes of a vaccine. It was an accepted childhood infection that came with very little risk. Now, in third world countries where children are malnourished and you know have horrible sanitation and have a million other pre-existing morbidities or you know other problems, measles can kill. But the fact of the matter is in first world countries, before the vaccine, no one cared about measles. And if you look around, you'll see it was a joke of a disease. The Brady Bunch has a whole episode where the whole family comes down with measles. I mean, it was a joke. It was literally thought of that trivially that a TV show, sitcom, could do an entire show about it without batting an eye.
By the way, they've taken that show off the internet. Did you know that? Hulu or whatever the streaming company is, they took it down, that episode of the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, so the thing, you know, and you remember in 2014 the Disneyland measles outbreak that they, you know, leveraged to maximum fear. I think it was either 53 or 58% of the people who had measles at Disneyland got it from a vaccine itself. And your listeners may not know this, but live virus vaccines such as measles, mumps, rubella, they can inadvertently create outbreaks of the disease. And this is why if you ever go to a cancer ward or some other places with what they call immune compromised people, they'll ask you, have you been recently vaccinated? Because they don't want you there if you've been recently vaccinated. So interestingly, that Disneyland measles outbreak, over half the people with measles got it from a vaccine. Now, of course, the news will never tell you that. And that didn't come out until recently. But the fact of the matter is, it's an innocuous, trivial illness before the vaccine. But once the vaccine came out, you know, public health officials and media go into overdrive to make you fear it. Same thing happened with chickenpox. No one was begging for a chickenpox vaccine. There was no childhood chickenpox foundation where people were, you know, giving millions of dollars in hopes of a vaccine. It was a profit-making opportunity, and unfortunately, seems to be the cause of the rise in shingles because naturally circulating chickenpox virus works as what they call exogenous boosting, which is where it basically reprimes your immune system as an adult so that you don't get shingles. But now that there's not a lot of naturally occurring chickenpox virus floating around, we have a rise in shingles, an explosion in shingles. And curiously, we also have a shingles vaccine. So the pharma won twice there. They got a chickenpox vaccine to be mandatory for all children, and then they won a shingles vaccine on the back end of it. If I could just circle back real quick to the autism thing, I just want to mention something because you had mentioned about the multi-generational thing. I want to talk about girls for a second because this is really important to the whole autism conversation. There was no neurological illness that appears in the historical record that favored boys so prevalently. If you go all throughout the 1800s and 1900s, you will never find anything resembling autism unless you look really hard and you might see a case here, you might see three cases here. I mean, it will pop up. It's not like it's not there, but it's extremely rare. Now, one thing that is doesn't appear to happen is you never saw anything that favored boys so heavily. If you don't know this, autism is predominantly a male disorder, 4 to 1. four boys for every one girl.
Wow.
In the initial Leo Connor study, there were 11 children he had seen, 8 boys, 3 girls. In the initial Asperger study, 200 boys, not a single girl. So if you look through the historical record at mental illness, you would expect to see, even if they didn't call it autism, if they called it something else, if it was sort of hidden within something else, you would expect to see some sort of male prevalent something somewhere. You know, for something to be so significantly male specific, you would expect to see it, but you don't. And I think I know why. People hypothesize that it has something to do with testosterone or estrogen protecting the brain. But for babies that are 12 to 18 months old, there is almost no difference, quantitative difference, in the amount of estrogen or testosterone baby boys and baby girls have. They're nearly hormonally identical in that regard. However, there is a significant difference with the female brain that is considered the single biggest differentiator between genders other than pregnancy and childbirth, and that is the response to stress.
Oh.
This has been proven over and over. People who study these things will tell you. There's a book, if you want to read about it, it's a fascinating book called The Tending Instinct, T-E-N-D-I-N-G, The Tending Instinct. And what they've discovered is it appears that boys and girls both have this fight or flight response to fear, but when the going gets tough and things get really bad, where the boys may go to what I refer to as death feigning from immobilization and restraint, females tend to go into a different chemical state they call tend and befriend. And females start producing massive amounts of oxytocin, which is like the pain-relieving hormone. They tend to bond with their attackers. And I'm sure you've heard of these stories of women that were kidnapped, you know, and on the way to probably getting assaulted or killed, and somehow they're able to bond with their attacker, and it works. Like, it actually works. Their attacker lets them go. You've heard these stories before, but my theory or hypothesis is this is why girls don't have a problem with autism as much, because when they're immobilized and restrained, their brainstem doesn't actively signal for white blood cells as aggressively as the male brain. Now, of course, your mileage may vary. Everyone's different. This is not a binary black or white issue. But in general, girls obviously have less frequent autism by a long shot. And knowing that they biologically have a very significant different stress response than males do, and also at the same time hypothesizing that the stress response is the main reason the ingredients from vaccines end up in the brainstem, it does start to make you wonder if there's not something to it.
So let me ask you something. What do you think of this chlorine dioxide for autism?
Are you talking about MMS?
Yeah.
I'm not a cure guy. I'm not, and not that I don't believe in it. I'm just saying it's not something I research. I'm trying to stop the bleeding. I focus on cause. I want at some point in my life to start looking at cure and help. But most of my research focuses on cause and understanding.
Okay, so you don't have any comment on Ms. Rivera's chlorine dioxide cure for autism?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. I get attacked enough as it is. If I started talking cures, people really, that's how you get banned off Amazon. If you talk autism and cures, people get banned.
Before we run out of time, I just want to mention your two website addresses. One is the autismvaccine.com, and the other is forestmarady.com, forestmarady.com. The new book is The Autism Vaccine, The Story of Modern Medicine's Greatest Tragedy, coming out May 1st. Is that right?
Correct. Next Wednesday.
Congratulations!
Say what?
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm super excited. It'll come out May 1st on Amazon if they don't ban it. And it will probably, we'll see, be available on that website as well. You can just remember the autismvaccine.com. It will direct you to my website. There'll be more information about the book on there and my other books.
Okay.
But it's a crazy story.
Jesse, we can't see you, so we don't know how much time we have left. But in whatever moments we have left, I wondered, could you just tell us a little bit about how you have how you've experienced the terrain of the story since you embarked on this? Because your books are, as I quoted that tweeter in the beginning, your books are a real threat. They're so meticulously researched. What has happened to you since you began this work?
I don't know. It's been an interesting.
It's not something you bring up in the last 2 minutes of the show, but let me put it this way: do you feel? How do you feel with the book coming out in a few days? With the new book coming out in a few days, do you think you could get banned off Amazon?
It may. I expect things will get worse. And when Christina was asking about the measles hysteria that's going on, all of this is a natural human response to cognitive dissonance. It is the sign of people panicking because what they thought was true may not, in fact, be true. And I went through the same thing. You know, people like you or I, for whatever reason, there are people out there who are willing to question their own beliefs. They're willing to go through a lot of self-examination and read things they may not agree with. Most people are not like that. Most people want to go through their life never changing their opinion about anything and believing all the things they were told as children are true. So what you're seeing right now is sort of the spasmodic twitching of a dying cockroach. You know, it's people starting to react, realizing that the narrative we've been told our whole life, which were vaccines saved us from all sorts of disease, when people start to realize maybe that's not actually true, maybe they weren't the savior we have always made them out to be, and in fact, maybe they are causing more harm than good, it's going to create some turbulence. And in fact, I expect it to get much worse than it is now. You're seeing some just hysterical responses, you know, quarantining college students, all these fines and things like this. It's just absolute hysteria.
Well, let's hope we'll sail through all that. We have to wrap up now, but listen, you have our deepest gratitude for coming on. That's for sure.
Yeah. God bless you for your work, and we hope you'll come back sometime, and really excited for you for May 1st. We're going to spread the word. Amazing book.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.